Can I just say, they literally sent Cosmo, their official literally sent Cosmo to Eindhoven, which is in the Netherlands, to become like the like expert on this particular type of microscope for all of North America.
Well, that's maybe exaggeration a little bit, but I was the representative from North America.
But how is that an exaggeration then?
I don't cover all of North America. Didn't. In my job, I just covered Manhattan.
Welcome back to I'm the Villain. Today we're talking to my friend Cosmo, who I've known for almost a third of my life. We met in college. And my friend Cosmo does like one of the coolest jobs of all of my friends that I know of. So we're going to talk about that. And Cosmo, why don't you just give a quick introduction, whatever you think the audience should know about you?
Sure. Hey, my name's Cosmo. I'm assistant director of cryo-electron microscopy at Columbia's Zuckerman Institute. And I've got a background in engineering, but a little bit of biology. And cryo-electron microscopy basically is a nice congruence of those two sciences, where it's using immense engineering technology and kind of decades of scientific development to look at biological specimens. And that's kind of a new development in electron microscopy. So it's kind of a subfield of a subfield of a subfield. But basically, in essence, we're looking at proteins. That's kind of the main question. Like, what are you looking at in the electron microscopes in this life science application? And yeah, we're looking at proteins that could be any, you know, I guess I should start by saying electron microscopes can be used for looking at kind of anything you're interested in, like anything in the world can really be ultimately prepared in a way that can be looked at in an electron microscope. But only just recently, in the last like 30 years, 40 years, have we seen like big steps taken to be able to look at formerly living or organic samples, you know, so things that are,
because it would burn up.
Yeah, because the there's a lot of complexity to it, but yeah, that's in essence it. Yeah, basically biological samples. For the longest time, you weren't able to use, like, I guess it. It's a very. All the details are starting to culminate in my head, so I'm like, so basically, when, you know, electron microscopes now are powerful enough where you can look at atoms. Like you can, with a single image, like you can look
not
on
right.
a silicon. It's not right. It's too much information. I didn't need to see that level of detail, but it's cool. What you're able to get that in a, like one particular image on, let's say a TEM, there's basically two kinds of electron microscopes. I work with TEMs and there's SEMs, the difference being transmission electron microscopes versus a scanning electron microscope. Transmission electron microscopes, you can think of it as shadow puppets. You're like blasting electrons through a sample. Scanning electron microscopes, you're using a laser and you're scanning your sample like with a raster scan to get a overview. But to look at atoms under a TEM at really high magnification, let's say like silicon is a very common sample, they need to use a really high energy. So they use a ton of beam current. They're focusing like tons and tons of electrons at that silicon wafer so you can actually look at that. But if that were like, you know, protein, that protein is going to be sizzled instantly, you know, with that amount of voltage. So what you have to do is you have to really reduce the amount of electricity that you're using and do this low dose technique, is what we refer to it as. So basically a low beam overall current. And you get a lower, basically a lower number of electrons per, you know, unit area on your sample. But then what you end up with is a much lower signal. You end up with lower contrast, because basically electrons, you know, electrons are your mechanism by which you're seeing things. So the more electrons you have, the greater, you know, image quality you have, so to speak, and the greater contrast, and you're easy, you know, you can see things easier. So with this low dose, it took them many, many years. It took us a long time to develop basically a camera that could actually capture really, really high quality images with such a low dose. And so they've only recently, like in the last 20 to 30 years, have developed this direct electron detector, which basically is counting electrons at every pixel, and then you're able to get these really, really detailed images from a very low dose beam. And then the beauty of so cryo-EM, what you know, the samples that we're looking at, you basically purify a protein. Let's say you're studying some mechanism, like at Zuckerman, we're always studying brains. Every study is related to the brain, whether it be a disease or a pathway or a function or like some, you know, really anything related to the brain behavior, from kind of the macro scale down to the nanoscale in the brain. But for the cryo-EM, let's say you have a protein of interest, you know, it has some function, but you want to learn more about its structure. That's generally what the question scientists are seeking to answer. In protein biology, structure and function are more or less the same. They're synonymous. It's like if you change the structure of a protein, you change its function and vice versa. So for cryo-EM, we basically have you take a protein of interest and then you replicate that protein like many, many times through biochemistry or through some process to basically get a bunch of copies. And then you put that all into solution and you lay that out over a mesh film. And then you freeze that at this like very specific temperature, which is like minus 158 degrees Celsius. It's basically the temperature of liquid ethane. You freeze it at this temperature, and then and that's just so that the ice that's formed doesn't crystallize, because crystalline ice, it doesn't form a coherent crystal structure, because if it does that, then electrons are not able to pass through it, so you get basically no transmission, meaning a black picture, you know, just nothing in your image. Mm-hmm. So this is I'm covering a lot of ground in a very short amount of time.
I'm ready to start asking questions, if that's helpful.
Yeah. So I've just gone directly in. Yeah.
So my most basic question is like, what's the advantage of being able to look at biomatter through an electron telescope? Like, why is that important?
Microscope.
Wrong direction. Definitely. Basically, you know, for the longest time when we're answering biological questions, you know, since the 1800s, we've had light microscopes, and those have been often used to study biological things. Like, and we've, over time, we've improved light microscopy to a point where, you can look at really, really closely at cells. You can look at tissues. You can see at a very high magnification what's going on inside of a body, inside of a living thing.
Wait. When you say light, are you just talking about a literal microscope that has a lens that's magnifying the image into your eye?
Exactly. Yeah. That's okay. Like a normal tabletop microscope. That's a light microscope.
Got it.
And light microscopes were all we had for a very long time. And before electron microscopes were first invented in like the 30s, 40s, but then it took a while for them to really get off the ground in terms of commercialization and being widely used. But basically the advantage that's offered to you by an electron microscope is light microscopes are limited by the fundamental wavelength of a photon. So if you're resolving an image with light, you can only look at something that is smaller than like the wavelength of light. So if the wavelength of light is bigger significantly than what you're trying to see, let's say there's some tiny little thing, the wavelength of light is 400 to 700 nanometers or so, depending on the energy and stuff. if something is smaller than that, then light's never going to be able to resolve it, because the light will just like brush by it and not be affected by it. And it needs to be larger than that wavelength in order for that light to interact with it, and then for you to thus see it, because you seeing it as the light interacting with something and bouncing back to your eye, right? And it's like, light has its limitations in terms of seeing really small things. And no matter what we do with light microscopy, you wouldn't be able to build a lens powerful enough to actually look at something that's smaller than the wavelength of light. So the cool thing about electron microscopy is basically you're using electrons as your medium instead of photons. And rather than using a light source and shining that through your sample and putting it directly into your eye, it's kind of the opposite, or you're basically using an electron source, creating a laser, shining that laser through your, like creating a beam. It's like a, you have to condense the, there's basically an initial spray of electrons, but then you have to condense that all into a fine beam, but then you pass that beam through your sample to a detector, which in the case of light microscopy, that detector is your eye, right? Or a camera, if you have a HD camera connected to your microscope. But in electron microscopy, you can't see any of it by eye because we don't have electron detectors in our eyes. So it's like you need new types of detectors and cameras. But the advantage overall is just that you get a way higher ultimate resolution. Like you, the things that you can resolve, the wavelength of an electron is like on the picometer scale, where light is on the nanometer scale. So like the picometer scale would be like 10 to the minus 12 meters. So I think it's like, you know, a couple hundred, or maybe it's even fewer, like, I want to say like 12 picometer wavelength. I need to double check that. But it's like a 1 to 10.
I'm sure the audience is going to be like, yeah, fact Come checking on, Cosmo, you. Yeah.
It's like, but basically it's 1 to 10,000 times smaller than light. It's like, you know, you're able to see things on a much, much smaller scale. Yeah. And so it's gotten to the point where with a single electron microscope, like you can just take a single image of an atomic structure of like some large atom substance like silicon or something like that.
It's insane. It's weird to think about things being smaller than light.
Smaller than light. Yeah. You've heard of faster than light. Get ready for smaller than light. Yeah.
What is the, okay, so if someone has like Alzheimer's or something, right?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of brain you want to put in an electron microscope so you can figure out what's going on? Like what, whose brains is going in here?
Yeah. So you actually can't really look at, well, so there's two, there's two techniques in cryo, well, okay. Got to take a lot of steps back. There's like many different techniques in cryo-EM. Most of them, you're not looking at like brain tissue. You're actually looking at, like I said, like a, you take a protein and you purify that protein and you replicate it tons of times. And then you basically put the process that I do most often is this process called single particle TEM, where you're basically taking a single particle, replicate it a billion times, and then you put it into a bath and then you freeze it. And then you look at this basically one protein at a bunch of different orientations. So you have the same thing just in random assortment on like a plane, right? And then you're able to go through with your microscope and image each area. And you take all those images and put them together and you get basically a structure, a model of your protein. And that's done through some like image processing techniques. Basically, you're looking at a bunch of two-dimensional images, but you're taking those hundreds of thousands of images and you're combining them to create a three-dimensional structure. So it's not really tissues that we're looking at in that situation. But there is, in tomography is another technique that's often used in TEM. In tomography, you're basically able to take like a something that's a bit more massive than just like one protein. Let's say like a single neuron, that's a common sample. But what you have to do is you have to cut into the neuron so you can see inside of it because it's got like a membrane. So what they'll do is they'll basically take a neuron embedded in ice and use an ion laser to mill away at the material. You're like, it's like, imagine like a really powerful fire hose or something like blasting away material. Like, So they spray this ion beam in a very, very calculated and precise manner to like get the exact area that they want of their cell exposed, and thin enough that the electron beam can pass through it. And then through tomography, they shine the beam through it and they take a bunch of images. And what's cool about tomography is the stage has the ability to rotate. So you basically, you know, you thin down this neuron to like a single plane where you're interested in looking. And then you can rotate that plane and observe it from like a whole 140 degree range. So it's like you go from minus 70 to plus 70 degrees and you get this huge field of view. So that's kind of more like the instance where you could take a neuron from a living, or from, there's no like living people.
No, I know they're not alive.
Oh, okay.
I guess the point is, what are they looking at the protein? Like, what does knowing what the protein looks like help you do?
I see. Yeah. So since protein structure and function, protein structure and function are basically synonymous, right? So a lot of the time, biochemists are basically just investigating, like, they're studying there's so many different applications, but I'll start with an example that we can all relate to, which is, let's say, COVID and COVID vaccine development. In the early days of COVID vaccine development, we actually had the structure for COVID way before COVID became a pandemic. So, but basically what you're doing is you're looking at the virus and you're looking at specific proteins on the virus, the receptors by which you would get a drug to attach to the virus. So you're looking for targeting sites for drugs, basically. So that, you know, biochemically, you need something that will perfectly match that receptor. If you want something to bind to COVID, you need it to match the receptors on COVID. So you need to know the exact biochemical structure of those receptors. So you can basically take COVID, you can, through biochemistry, like, isolate one of those proteins of interest, one of those spike proteins where you could potentially have a drug latch on. And then you do that process I was saying where you replicate that protein from COVID a bunch of times, and then you put it into a slurry, and then you freeze it onto a sample, and then you put it in the electron microscope. And you basically study that one protein. You get hundreds of thousands of images of that one protein at a bunch of different angles, and then you put it together in a reconstruction to get this three-dimensional model. And then from that, again, these applications, it can vary a lot based on what you're studying. But for the case of COVID, you know, then you're looking at drug recipes or, you know, molecules that you've created in the lab, and then seeing if they're compatible with this receptor that you've basically now got the structure for. But in the case of COVID, like, we had the structure for COVID long before it was, you know, a huge pandemic. Like, they were already studying it, and they had a structure in, like, late 2018 already or something like that, or early 2019. Because COVID's been around for a long time, right? It took a while for there to be a variant that actually blew up.
Right.
But
that's anyway. Kind of hilarious to me, though, that they're basically like, obviously it's very high tech, but also in a lot of ways it's extremely rudimentary, yeah. Right? Where you're just like,
something very mechanical about it.
Yeah, where you're just like, oh, okay, we need to figure out, like, you know, how to treat this. So you just, like, you know, you have your little, like, you know, pirate spyglass, and you, like, whip it out, and you just, like, you know, look at it, and then you're just like, oh, well, that's what it looks like. You know, we just need a key that fits this exact lock, right?
It's just, it's a tremendous number of steps to get to the point where you're looking at a single... a single molecule that's been purified and so on. It is very, very, it's taken decades and decades and decades of development to get it down to this point where, yeah, actually we can kind of do that, where you're like, oh, we need this done in 2 weeks. Like, that's doable now, or you can just, like, do it. But yeah. For a long time, it took, like, years to get one of these studies done, you know, years and years. But yeah, no, the technology has improved a lot. The microscopes are streamlined. Now there's, like, you can load multiple samples at once. You can do it. They've made all of these changes and improvements, and it's actually still in that phase where it's very much in R&D. There's still tons of development being done for all the software involved. The cameras are being improved constantly. The microscopes and the electron microscope technology has been kind of stagnant for the last, like, 10, 20 years. Not much has changed in terms of electron optics. You know, they're not, like, able to make those electrons move any better than, you know, they pretty much got the optical mechanism down. It's not like there's a lot of improvement. So, but there's tons still to be done with basically this software I'm talking about, where you're taking tons of images and combining them and creating this structure. And there's tons of things with, like, filtering out noise. And methods for getting the crispest model possible.
Mm-hmm. How big is an electron microscope?
It depends. There's, you know, you can get ones that are really small, and really small one would be like larger. It's like a microwave sized almost. Like you could fit it on. They call it a desktop SEM because you could like put it on top of your desk. But then the biggest ones, the ones that I work on primarily, the TEMs are like, they can range from like 8 feet tall to up to the largest one, the Krios or the Titan. There's kind of basically the Titan is the name of the overall model, but then they have a bunch of different specializations, right, based on what you're looking at. So for the cryo-EM, we're using what's called a Titan Krios. But then for like material science, if you're looking at like computer chips under the microscope, they would use a Titan Themis. Basically, these are all Thermo Fisher microscopes. I used to work for Thermo Fisher.
Can I just say, they literally sent Cosmo, Thermo Fisher literally sent Cosmo to Eindhoven, which is in the Netherlands, to become like the like expert on this particular type of microscope for all of North America. Like,
well, that's maybe an exaggeration a little bit, but I was the representative from North America.
Well, how is that an exaggeration then?
It's like I don't cover all of North America. In my job, I just covered Manhattan. But it was basically I can talk more about that experience. But the large microscopes are like 15 feet tall. It's like 14 and a half feet. Just to finish that question before we dive into something else.
Got it. No,
so they're very big.
I was just trying to get a visual of like what it looks like to mess around with an electron microscope, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like you're mostly just looking at a computer screen, right? It's like a software interface and you're outside the room where the microscope actually is. And so you're just kind of sitting at a computer and driving around. But the microscope basically takes up the whole room that it occupies most of the time, unless it's on like some production floor or whatever, where they've got a few of them and it's some giant warehouse space. But for the most part, it's like these dedicated rooms that have like a lot of built-in controls and facilities. Like the room humidity needs to be well controlled, the temperature needs to be well controlled, they need to prevent electromagnetic interference from outside sources like trains or we have MRIs at Columbia that can sometimes interfere with our equipment. So there's a ton of stability checks. Basically, you have anti-vibration tables under the microscope. So anytime the train goes by and the ground rumbles, we have it isolated and you don't see any of that vibration, because everything needs to be super stable. Because if you think about it, you're looking at things on like the micron,
If they move like a millimeter, it changes everything.
Screwed. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you can't sneeze.
Exactly. Exactly. So, the rooms are really cool. Like they're very, they're kind of a whole project of their own, like a science project of their own, because they've got so many bells and whistles, so to speak. But the microscope takes up a room. And then, Isabel, what was the question? Or you had something... the Eindhoven thing. I can talk more about Eindhoven and just like that experience if you want. Or
yeah,
what do you think?
Please.
Sure.
Tell us why they picked you, how they picked you.
Sure. Yeah. Basically, I was a field service engineer for Thermo Fisher Scientific for their cryo TEMs. So for these kind of the subsection of electron microscopes that are for the biological research, they hired me as a service technician, basically, or
like a microscope handyman.
Basically, is my job to travel around Manhattan, New York, and install microscopes, fix them. But when I started, I had very little experience. Like I had done a couple of summers of electron microscope research at this point, and then I had interned for FEI, and then Thermo. They were acquired by Thermo Fisher eventually. The company was originally called FEI, but I interned for them for like a year and a half. So I had some experience, but I was basically sent to New York with no idea how to put a microscope together. Some idea, I should say. So they really needed to train me. It's a lot to ask just, hey, can you go start servicing microscopes right away? You know, you start the job by doing a lot of shadowing. You work with other engineers who have been on the job for a long time. And then you actually kind of, that's how you get your first experience. You know, they delegate tasks to you and you sort of, it's interesting because each person's training is highly, you know, it's very variable. It depends a lot on who you're working with and how good of a teacher they are and like which region you're in. And it's all very small teams. You know, they don't have a lot of people doing this. So like just for the whole New York area, we probably had like 18 guys, and that's including like Connecticut. And so it's, it's a fairly small group of us. So you're all learning together and collaborating, but ultimately you need to be kind of formally trained. So the way that they've always done training is they fly people to where the microscopes are actually manufactured, which is in Eindhoven, the Netherlands. And they'll send you for like a week or two at a time to get hands-on training. And like, it usually, that what they told me when I first started is it normally takes somebody about 5 years of going once or twice a year to Eindhoven, to feel like you're like ready to go, like you're fully trained and like, you're ready to be like 5 years of training. And then you're like a competent, independent engineer. And I was like, wow, that's really, it really lowered the expectations for me because I thought I had to be like at par or at parity, you know, to begin with. So it really, made me feel better. But basically they decided to wheel out this faster training program. They said, this is way too slow, this 5-year plan. So they wanted to do this high intensity training program where you basically go and immerse yourself in the factory and work in the factory and, you know, spend every second, every minute living and breathing electron microscopes. And then that, you know, instead of doing 2 weeks, once or twice a year for 5 years, just do 6 weeks, or sorry, 6 months all at once and just go through all the steps and get kind of exposure to everything. And then go back and do your job. And so, and when they were looking for volunteers to do this, I felt like it was perfect for me because I was one of the youngest people on my team. I think I was the second youngest person ever to be on the team. I was hired when I was 23. So I was like 24 when they picked me because everyone else who I worked with was like in their 40s and their 50s, maybe in their 30s. But a lot of them had families, they had wives, they had kids. They had like these, you know, highly structured lives that they couldn't just say, hey, I'm moving to the Netherlands for 6 months. So I had that luxury of being single, being freshly out of college and just looking for experience. So I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And my boss had me in mind because of my circumstances and everything. I was brand new. I was very eager. So they sent me and I ate it up.
Wow. What an incredibly unique experience.
Right. Yeah.
It was very cool. It was very lonely, I will say, being
right.
There.
It sounds quite lonely.
It was very odd being in a city, but very luckily, actually, there was this guy that I met, Bart Linson. He's a good friend of mine. We haven't been in touch in the last year or so, but we've, you know, he basically came to New York City for an installation we had at NYU, and he like helped out. And he's roughly my age. I think he's a year older, but. We became fast friends when he was in New York, and then he's from the Netherlands. So when I went there, he was basically my guide, my host. He did, you know, we did everything, or he was my only friend. So in my mind, we did everything together, but we really only hung out like once a week. But, you know,
right.
When I wasn't with Bart, I was doing absolutely nothing. So it was really great to have this connection though, because otherwise I would have been completely isolated and, you know, a bit miserable.
Were your work hours like standard 8-hour work days?
Yeah, it was like it was actually really weird. When I first got there, they didn't really the person who coordinated the whole program did not coordinate a program. It was a little bit depressing. I basically got there and the factory manager who I was told to go and find and who I was told had like a program ready for me. I got there and they were basically like, who are you and why are you here? And I was like, I'm the guy that's here from, like, I'm the US. There were six of us that were supposed to come, like two from Taiwan and then like two from, I forgot who all the members were, but I remember I was the only US guy and I got there and I was like, I'm the US HIT student, the high intensity training program. And they were like, we have no idea what you're talking about.
But
eventually they were like, oh, right. We got an email about this like 5 months ago. Sure, we'll find a spot for you. And they just like made the arrangements right there and then. But it was very eerie and weird that there was like no communication about it beforehand. I was very like, guys, coordinators who have my life in their hands, like they just sent me to the Netherlands with no plan in place. But then it ended up working out really well, where the factory is like, all right, free labor. Like they just throw you into a room basically and ask you to do what everyone else is doing. And then they move you around. And so you do really get exposure to like every part of the process, I guess, for the microscopes, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's like very like bread and butter approach to learning how these things work. They're like, all right, you're today you're putting lenses together, like
exactly.
Or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's insane.
It was really funny.
And I'm guessing did they pay for like all of your living expenses and stuff?
Yeah. It was a nice financial break because they were also paying for my meals. So it was like I got to save quite a bit of money while I was there just because I wasn't paying for food. And that was huge. Yeah. And also I had to keep my apartment in New York. I was able to sublet a tiny bit, but it was just because everything happened so quick. It was actually very hard to, they would let me know like 2 weeks ahead of, they let me know 2 weeks before leaving. Like, by the way, you're going to the Netherlands for 6 months. So I had very little time to arrange that kind of stuff. But it ended up working out. Because they paid for my living, so I didn't mind paying rent. It was no big deal. But
got it.
Yeah.
Rent back in the States was like your only expense.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, it was... go ahead.
When you got back, did you feel like ultra competent, or are you like still learning stuff, or do you feel like, no, like I am the arbiter of these telescopes or me of these microscopes? Sorry.
I definitely don't feel like I'm the arbiter. I feel competent. I feel very comfortable with the machines. So basically I knew that this was all in 2018, and I knew the company told me, you know, you're going to learn, you know, you're being sent to the Netherlands so that when you come back, you can install 3 of these microscopes. The orders are already like in paper and you are already designated as the primary engineer.
You had tangible goals when you got back.
So it was very clear to me what the end goal was. Like, okay, so when I get back from this trip, I need to be ready to... So I knew very clearly, well, not very clearly, but you know, I had this idea in my mind, and that was kind of what always drove me, is not wanting to get back to New York and just being like,
I have no
completely
clue
underprepared. Yeah, that was my nightmare. So I just kept that in my mind, and that's how I kind of guided all of my question asking and everything. It was just like I was trying to imagine, okay, so let's say I'm in a place in New York, and we're, because in the factory you're basically, yeah, you're building it up piece by piece, and then you test it out, make sure it works, and then you basically package it up and ship it. When you're installing one, it's kind of the reverse process, where you receiving it and then you unpack it, install it, make sure it works, and then give it to, you know, hand it off to the customer. And I just wanted to be really certain that I could go through all those steps. And luckily, you know, they do have a very, coherent process for how this all goes down. And it's actually not that much different installing a microscope in a factory, compared to like a customer location, because those customer locations, you know, the rooms have to be pre-designed for with the microscope in mind. So it's kind of like a little factory in there, you know, like all the lines for the air and water and everything are in the perfect places, and it's all very neat. Right. So,
yeah. Talk about motivating. Like, I feel like that is just like a very, like, you know,
that's true.
Smart goal. Like, it's like the most tangible thing that you can possibly, you know, be driving towards, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, those installations, they went well. And I would say that I know what I'm doing, but it is worth saying, like, there were so many problems that I could not have foreseen. And electron microscopes are just very complex beasts that have like very kind of multifaceted, you've got air powered pneumatics, like valves and stuff. You've got electronics, you've got a water system for cooling. You've got all these moving parts and so many things that can go wrong, basically. And, I just have been through the ringer. I was told that each installation should take about 3 months. One of them took 6 months, and then had like basically the microscope filled with water over time. And this was not my fault. I also, disclaimer, I should say, it was a condition. It was basically from the condition they sent it from the factory with a leaking water connection inside the microscope. So like over months and months, it was a very slow leak, but over months and months and months of usage, the one that it took us like months to even get it installed and working in the first place. And then like a year later, I get this call that there's like all these problems with things. I go in there to like take a look and it's full of water because it's just been sitting there like seeping and leaking up. And I was amazed that it even worked in the first place because there was no water in the area where the sample is and everything because that's all like isolated and vacuum. But the rest of the microscope where all the electronics and stuff, yeah, just completely wet. It was
just full of water.
Just full of water. It was nuts. Wow. So yeah, that, we had to completely take it apart and disassemble it, replace all the lenses and completely put it back together, but it all worked out. But just talk about a nightmare, you know, like a nightmare system did not go ideally at all.
You've made a move though from like microscope service person to like microscope user/researcher, right?
Yeah.
What inspired the move?
Yeah, that's a really, I love the question. And it's, I'm excited, but sometimes questioning my own decision in that like switch. But basically, you know, I have always been fascinated by microscopy in general. Like I've always thought it was cool being able to look at stuff that, you know, you're unable to see with your eye, basically. You have the ability to just kind of uncover these secret worlds that were, you know, and look, I think I'm a very visually driven learner and a very visual person. So it's just very satisfying to get an image of something that has kind of, you know, maybe you've like heard about in theory or you've seen drawings of or whatever, like some, but then to actually get kind of this concrete proof, that's kind of the initial inspiration for why microscopes in general. So my whole intention with getting into microscope engineering in the first place was I just really wanted to get as close as possible to the microscopes because I knew that I thought it was really cool and I thought it was really engaging and fun to like science to be a part of. And I knew that I just wanted to do microscopy of some sort. So I just did field service engineering as this way to kind of get my foot in the door, get experience with the microscopes, get some hands-on experience with the microscopes, understand how they work. And then maybe through that, I could eventually leverage into like being a microscopist, so to speak. And the motivation was, yeah, after 6 years of kind of taking an empty room, building up a microscope, and then handing it over to people as soon as it's ready to go, you begin to wonder like, man, wouldn't it be cool if I could just stick around a couple more weeks and see what they do?
It's like you just birthed this baby.
Yeah, I just birthed this beautiful machine.
Grow up.
I did all the tests to prove it can collect really good data. I've proven that the image quality is very absurdly good. And now I get to leave and now I get to go to a different empty room or just a problem that needs to be fixed. That was the majority, you know, if you're not installing something, then you're just answering calls, putting out fires is what we call it. Like you get a call, hey, somebody's such and such is broken. You've got to go there, spend a couple of days fixing it. But yeah, it sucks to like get something in working condition and then just be like, all right, have fun with it. This beautiful machine. I just got really curious and I have enough biology background that I have a genuine curiosity about these like biochemical and structural biology questions and like know enough about the mechanisms, I guess, to be able to work with scientists from an engineering standpoint and a microscopy standpoint. I can interpret what they're saying well enough that we can collaborate and like I can help them to kind of fine tune things for their projects and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So is the process, the workflow, like a scientist that doesn't have the expertise in electron microscopy comes to you or like comes to your company and is like, we want to look at this subject and like essentially like do they like pay you all to do that? Is that how your company makes money?
For Columbia, Columbia basically is all, at least, so Columbia has two basically Columbia has two cryo-EM labs. There's one on the main medical campus, and then I work at the lab that's located at the Zuckerman Institute. So it's kind of separated from the rest of the Columbia campus. And the site that I work at is very, it's like all in-house. Like, we only do research, or we only run samples for people that are in the building, which is kind of a rare model. I think most people, they do a lot of outsourcing, or they do a lot of, so there's like, there are these three national centers of cryo-EM. One's located in New York City. That was the place where I installed the three Krioses in 2019. Basically, they're called New York Structural Biology Center. And they have this really cool model where they basically, you know, it's all merit-based. You submit an application with your sample of interest and what you intend to do with it and why you need this data. And they do this, they basically sift through all these applications and pick they pick the best ones, and then they run those samples. And it's cool because it's all funded by NIH. It's all cost-free. It's cost-free for the user. So it's like, I think it's an amazing model, because NIH basically gave them a bunch of money so that they could buy all these expensive microscopes, but then give out the service to those that need it, but have the merit, or like the, you know, they've got the good questions, the meaty questions. Whereas at Columbia, like, we're a bit more private. Like, we just basically have our, at Zuckerman, it's like our microscope, our users, our questions, that's it. But for the most part, for my job, it's like, yeah, there's four labs that I work with, and many of them have like really experienced people that know exactly what they're doing. Some of them have people that have never done this before, and they just come to me like, hey, you know, I've got this sample ready. I have no idea what it's going to look like, but can we just load it and take a couple initial images to get an idea? Or sometimes a really experienced person will just say like, hey, Cosmo, I don't have time to run this sample. Can you just like queue it up for me? Basically meaning like, can you go through the steps of collecting good images for me, you know, and kind of jump through those hoops. So it's really whatever that specific user needs. It's on a user by user basis. And we basically just have like a sign up sheet, or, you know, an online sign up. And every week it could be a different person, could be multiple. It depends on the length of the sessions and so on. But for the most part, we do like 3 to 5 day sessions, sometimes longer. But you can collect a good amount of images in like 3 to 5 days.
So the former editor-in-chief of Wired, Kevin Kelly, has this quote. I don't know if I'll be able to quote it exactly, but it's like, there's no technology that we've created that has not been that humans have created that can't be weaponized. So my question is, in what way do you think you could weaponize an electron microscope?
It'd be very difficult.
You think it'd be really difficult? I mean, it's a giant laser, Cosmo.
Yeah, but it's a laser that only works in vacuum.
Points at one. Okay.
It only works in vacuum, like, because.
So you could make it into a space.
Space
a
laser.
Space weapon.
Marjorie Taylor
Greene. LOL.
No, so the electron, because electrons, you know, think of it like this way, like, you know, you can't just have an electron beam in atmosphere because they'll interact with the gas.
They'll go everywhere.
So there's like,
okay,
so for an electron microscope to work, they have like this really complex multifaceted vacuum system where there's multiple types of pumps that get it down to different, you know, you've got one set of pumps that pumps it down to a certain level, and then another set of pumps take over because they can go even further, then a different more powerful type of pump takes over, and it just keeps sucking and sucking and sucking until it's like bone dry in there. And then, so there's no.
Also, I can imagine why having it filled with water would have actually made it totally.
So what? Like, So that area, the vacuum area, was still without water. Otherwise, you're right. It would have never worked. But the other places that were not the vacuum were full of water, which is still crazy because there's like live circuits, you know, like, underwater, and you're like, how did this work? Yeah. Anyway, sorry. What was the? I lost track of the original.
Can it be weaponized?
Can it be weaponized? Right. There's the laser can't exist outside of this like highly controlled environment that is all contained within the microscope. I think in terms of the research, I do think that there is some potential, but, you know, if you really were devious, you could, in theory, use it to study, like, you know, any let's say you wanted to like modify COVID to make it more resistant.
For like bio warfare or something.
Exactly. Like you could in theory use it to develop or change a virus's, you could potentially try to modify a virus's function to make it more resistant to the drugs that we have, to the to the vaccines. That's something I could see, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that sounds extremely complex. And what are you doing with your life if that's what you're
Well, that's a better answer than the only thing I could think of is you have to take, if you wanted to use it as a weapon, you'd have to shrink the person you're trying to fight with into an atom size and then put them inside the microscope and
that's
zap
the case,
them.
The final zap is like the least of our problems, right?
That's true.
We've got a shrink ray to deal with. Yeah.
Right. There's many, much more pressing issues than that final zap in the electron microscope.
Yeah. But I think for the most part, like they're super safe. We have all these safety checks done all the time by environmental health and safety because it is like very high voltage equipment. The microscope I use uses 300,000 volts as the accelerating voltage, which by comparison, your wall voltage is like 120. It's just a difference in current. It's like very high voltage, but very low current. So like your wall is able to just like, it's like a fire hose. You can like gush out a ton of, a bunch of water, but it's not very high powered. Whereas an electron microscope is like this microscopic hole shooting water at like an infinitely high speed. You know, it's just like, it's like that's more the comparison. So there's all these safety checks that we do to make sure that you're not going to get electrocuted, that you're not going to have your finger like sucked into the vacuum and ripped off or whatever. And there's all these like interlocks and stuff. So the microscopes themselves are like absurdly safe. Unless you're kind of like taking them apart and putting them together, then there's like some heavy lifting. I think you could weaponize it just by dropping one on someone.
Like, yeah.
They're pretty heavy.
Yeah, they're like 8,000 pounds or something like that. 6,000.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would do the job.
Yeah.
So when you're not living and breathing electron microscopy,
Microscopy.
Yeah. What do you like to do, Cosmo?
That's a good question. I'm a musician. I'm a gamer. I like to cook. Nice. I like to run. I like to ride my bike. And I like to hang out with my friends. I like to travel. There's a lot of things. I would say right now, I think coming out of post-COVID, like COVID made me double down on being a gamer. And I've been gaming a lot recently, but I feel like I'm trying to like pull out of that. I feel like as we reemerge in society, I'm like, this is a thing of the past, but it's so hard to escape. And it's so dang good when we've created all this community online. I think through COVID, I've got all these different communities I interact with. And that's been keeping me sane through the pandemic. But now it's 2023 and it's summertime and I've been trying to get out more and just experience life a bit more.
Yeah. Do you climb? I feel like you have a climber aesthetic.
I used to climb. I climbed.
Jar's like, I can smell him from a mile away. Yeah.
I climbed up like for about a year ago. Basically, one of my close friends in New York is really into climbing, and we got this membership, and we would go to the gym together. It was just so expensive for how often I was going. It was
You have to commit to the lifestyle.
Oh my God. New York climbing gym, it was $140 a month, and I went like once or twice a month sometimes more, but you know, like pretty infrequently, just to like do this with my friend. And after a while I was like, yeah, this is, it's really fun, it's really cool, like exercise that I feel like we as humans don't normally get to do that kind of thing, you know. It's like, how often are you? And it's really good for your, I don't know, I felt like it was really good for your joints and stuff. Like hanging is a really good thing to do for your spine and all that, but not worth the money in my mind. I mean, I think it's worth it if you utilize it, but I was not. So.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Cosmo, thanks so much. It's been great chilling with you. Do you have anything you want to plug? Anything you want to promo?
No, I'm good. I'm currently promoless. I've been like reducing my social media usage. If I have something to promote, I'll let you know.
Cool.
But I'm on the anti-promo lifestyle right now. I'm trying to live under a rock. Yeah.
No promos. Except for this.
Yeah.
You can find us at I'm the Villain Pod. that's our Instagram, our Gmail, and our Twitter. Otherwise, bye everyone.